Let us together mindfully invite Ajahn Brahm to deliver his talk. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. Thank you for comparing me to Ajahn Chah. This is very humbling. But, as I promised those people who are on retreat today, for this evening's talk, I'm going to be talking about mindfulness, what it means, how it's developed, and also what its result is. And most importantly, how it's important to put compassion together with mindfulness. Because without compassion, mindfulness has no real power. Many years ago, I was speaking at a conference on meditation in Sydney. And one of the people who was presenting with me was a professor from Stanford University who was doing experiments in mindfulness. And he got funding from his university. Stanford is very rich. To have a number of his students do this test. He split the students up into two groups, as you have to do when you do tests, the control group and the group who are going to do this practice. He sent half of those students to a meditation retreat for the day where they practice mindfulness. And the other students, they sent at the university's expense to a spa for the day. A California spa, where you get hot baths and saunas and massage and hot oil or warm oil poured over you. He wanted to find out who becomes more relaxed at the end of the day. And when both groups returned, the one who'd done meditation through mindfulness and the one who went to the spa, they gave them the standard test to see how relaxed they were. And the people who went to the spa were far more relaxed. Which says there's something wrong going on with that meditation. If you get more relaxed going to a spa than meditating, there's something wrong. And the reason why there was something wrong was, yes, you were doing mindfulness, but there was no kindness there. If we can only add compassion and kindness together with the mindfulness, then we'd get powerful results. And so many people who teach mindfulness meditation, sometimes they get so serious, so strict, and so angry, you wonder, what are they doing? It's not enough. Just like that story of the wealthy lady who came to listen to my talk one evening here in Brickfields. She was very wealthy, and she knew that there were many burglars around the area in the Klang Valley. So she had a guard, her own personal security guard, and she told the guard, "Be mindful. There are many burglars in this area. I want you to be mindful." And he said, "Yes, madam, I will be mindful." And she went off to my talk. And when she came home afterwards, she found the burglars had been into her house and stole so many things. She was upset at her guard and started scolding him. "You stupid guard, I told you to be mindful, and all these burglars have got into the house." And he said, "But madam, I was mindful. I saw the burglars going into your house, and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them taking all your jewelry out. I noted, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw them going back inside again. Burglar going back, burglar going back. I noted. I saw your safe. with all your cash coming out. Save coming out, save coming out. Say, I was very mindful, madam. Now, of course, you see, just being mindful is not enough. We also have to have something else as well as mindfulness. And that missing ingredient is like being kind, having compassion. If you put those two together, my goodness, is very, very powerful. For those who weren't here earlier, I told a story how mindfulness together with compassion will teach you how to relax your own body. And I told the story of how I got rid in 20 minutes of a very painful food poisoning. I'll just tell it in brief again for those who weren't here earlier. I had very bad food poisoning. It's what I call occupational hazard for a monk, because you feed me and I'm not quite sure what you're feeding me. So this has some bugs in it. And so that I got food poisoning. It was very painful. Instead of going to the doctor, after a while, I decided to practice mindfulness together with compassion on this terrible pain in my intestines. What the mindfulness did, I just knew those feelings in my guts, the very painful feelings. And through kindness, whenever I was kind to those feelings, I found that the feeling of pain got less. The mindfulness gave me feedback. So I could see that the sensations changed. They started getting more relaxed. So I knew I was going in the correct direction, getting feedback. A little bit more kindness, the feelings got less. More compassion, the feelings got less. Until it only took me 20 minutes by practicing mindfulness together with compassion to have all of that food poisoning totally disappear. And I was healthy again. That's my own personal experience of practicing mindfulness together with kindness. The two are what relaxes and soothes the pain and lets go of all of this inner problem inside. And after a while of practice, you can be so aware of the feelings inside your own body, and you can see them change whenever they get more relaxed and comfortable. That is what kindness means. You know what kindness means, because when you're in the presence of a kind person, you relax. You're at ease. Everything gets loose. But if I was a very fierce monk and very tough, sit up straight, stop doing this, da-da-da, then you get so tense, you wouldn't be relaxed at all. But when you're very kind and very soft and very gentle, then you relax. Sometimes I'm so soft and so gentle, you fall asleep. Many people have told me this. They listen to my talks before they go to bed at night, and they fall fast asleep. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. At least it makes you relax. But that kindness relaxes you. And after a while, by practicing mindfulness together with kindness, it's amazing what you can do with your own body. What you can do with your own body, you can actually heal some of these sicknesses inside of you. If it's a cancer, or some inflammation, or even things like a headache or a tummy ache, you can be aware of those feelings, add kindness, and you find that everything relaxes, disappears, and you're free. When I grew up in the streets of London, in the late 1950s, I'd spend a lot of my time playing soccer in the street with my friends. And for those of you who know soccer, when you went for a tackle and you fell over, you're falling over stone and bitumen. So I was always scraping the skin off my knees. Whenever I would have an injury like that, you know, with blood coming out, I'd run to my mother. And my mother would kneel down and she would put her lips on that knee and kiss it better. That's what you used to call it, kissing it better. And every time she kissed it, my mother, the pain disappeared and the wound never got infected. It's really surprising, because imagine putting a mouth full of germs on an open wound. That's very unhealthy. But it never got infected and the pain went away straight away. That was the first time I realized the power of compassion, to relax you, to allow healing to happen, and to take away the pain. That is how powerful it is to your own body. And many people who have been going through operations, who have great physical pain inside after the operation, it's amazing what you can do for your own body with mindfulness and kindness. The mindfulness keeps giving you feedback, telling you whether you're going in the right direction or not. And the wonderful thing is, it is kindness, compassion, which relaxes you. And this is actually where you learn what compassion truly is. Compassion is that attitude of mind which gives this wonderful sense of relaxation and freedom. That's what real kindness is. So that's what it is. And it could also be used to solve some of the emotional problems which people have. There was a question earlier, and I promised I would answer it this evening, on how to overcome things like anxiety and fear. And this story is one of my favorite stories, because this concerned a young lady who was in Adelaide. She was supposed to be studying dentistry at Adelaide University, but she had such severe anxiety disorder and depression that she was bedridden. And she'd been in bed for many weeks. Her local doctor and the psychologist were unable to help her. Her good piece of fortune was that her uncle was a strong supporter of mine. So her uncle, as a last resort, if the doctors and the psychologist can't help you, call Ajahn Brahm. So I'm the monk of last resort. We have a service in Perth called Dial a Monk Service. So she gave me a call, and from her bed she explained her situation. Her second piece of good fortune was that she had a boyfriend, the boyfriend from heaven. I mentioned the boss from hell, because this boyfriend, even though she was bedridden, cooked and cleaned for her and looked after her. It's very hard to find a boyfriend like that. If you have, never let him go. So, when she told me her situation, I asked her, when you get a panic attack, when you get this incredible anxiety, which means you're too afraid to even get out of your bedroom, where do you feel it in your body? So what do you mean, feel it in my body? It's an emotional disorder. So no. Whenever you have an anxiety attack, whenever you're afraid, you will have some corresponding physical feeling somewhere in your body. Where do you feel it? And at that she said, I don't know. So I told her, give me a call in a few days when you can tell me where you feel it. That was the first nice thing to do, to give her something to do, so that she could take some responsibility for her own treatment. 3 or 4 days later, she gave me a call, and she said, every time I get a panic attack, I feel it in my chest, just above my breast, below my neck, in here. Said, well done. Now, what does it feel like? Describe the feeling to me. She said, I can't. I said, give me a call in 3 or 4 days when you can. Now I was giving her a test So she had to learn how to describe these feelings to a monk she didn't know. It was teaching her that she must be mindful of those feelings. I had to establish mindfulness of those feelings for her. So she called me up in 3 days and gave me a very accurate description of what those feelings felt like in her own words. I said, wonderful. Now the next thing you have to do is either yourself get your hand and massage that area with as much kindness and compassion as you possibly can do. If you feel yourself too weak to do that, get your boyfriend to massage it. That's what boyfriends are there for. But make sure he does it with as much softness and tenderness and compassion as he can possibly do. And give me a call in 3 or 4 days. So that was the next part of her treatment. Again, she was having to take control of it. So she gave me a call in 3 or 4 days and said, yes, every time I got a panic attack or anxiety, I massaged that area. If I was too weak, I got my boyfriend to massage that area with lots of kindness. So what happened to that physical feeling? She said, well, it got much better. It disappeared. Because that's what happens when you get physical feelings. You stroke and massage them with kindness. They disappear. I said, well done. Now what happened to the emotion when the physical feeling disappeared? And that's when we have what we call the light bulb moment. When she paused and she said to me, and it's one of the great times, she said, when the physical feeling disappeared, so did the anxiety. It went. Exactly, I said. Because all those feelings, emotional in your mental world, always has a counterpart in the physical body as well. Now you weren't able to deal with that on the emotional level, you dealt with it on a physical level. So by calming the physical counterpart to anxiety, massaging that area until it disappeared, you'll find the corresponding anxiety will also disappear. Now you know how to deal with anxiety. Don't try and fight it in your mind. It just gets worse. It has a physical part to it. Be mindful of that. Add compassion to that physical feeling. Relax the body in that area where you feel the anxiety. And at the same time, your anxiety will vanish. She was out of bed in a week. She got back to university. She got first class with honors in dentistry. She's a very brilliant girl. And a couple of years later, she asked me to do the marriage ceremony for her and that boy. It was one of these beautiful endings. It's such a very good story. You should do a movie about it. She learned how to totally overcome her anxiety disorder when the psychologist just couldn't help her at all. Basically, mindfulness together with compassion and kindness. That is what works. The same if you get angry, that Venerable asked me yesterday. How do you overcome anger? Again, the same thing. If you try and fight anger in your mind, it gets worse. We call that getting angry at being angry. It's double anger. So instead, whenever you get angry, you will find, again, there is a physical feeling somewhere in your body. Usually somewhere in your chest, usually a bit lower down for most people. Whenever you get angry, there's a certain feeling in your body at the same time. So what to do to overcome the anger? Deal with that physical part of the emotion of anger. Massaging it is one of the wonderful ways of relaxing. Because we've all done massages. Maybe we've had a sore back, we get it massaged. Maybe we have a foot massage. Maybe we have a leg massage. I don't know, a nose massage. I don't know what massages they have these days. It's almost about everywhere. Actually, I've never had a nose massage. That's very interesting. I wonder what they do to have a nose massage. But anyway, I'm sure it works. But I do know that that relaxes because someone is being kind to you. And because of that kindness, that physical feeling associated with anger gets less and less and less until the anger disappears. The physical feeling goes, and with it, the anger. And of course, that's very helpful for any of you who do get afraid from time to time. You may be going for an interview for a new job. You may have to do a presentation for your business. You may be going to the doctor to find out the results of your biopsy. And you get very anxious. And how do you deal with that anxiety so you don't lose the contract? You make a nice presentation. You get the job if you go for an interview or whatever. How do you deal with that? By noticing your fear does have a physical counterpart, and deal with that fear on the physical level. Massage, relax, and you find the emotion goes as well. The way you can overcome fear. And even grief as well. When you've lost somebody you love very much, still there is a physical feeling as well. Massage it and the grief goes as well. That's why the mindfulness of the body and adding compassion is a wonderful way of relaxing the body and loosening the grip of the emotions on your mind, so that you're no longer a victim to such things as anger and anxiety, grief or guilt. A very powerful method, which again, I taught these psychologists, and now they are teaching their clients and charging money. I really should get a cut, because I invented this. But no, monks don't get a cut. We just give these things out for free. Why? So for the happiness and well-being of other people. That's why we just keep giving these things out. We don't want anything back in return. Just to see people live without anxiety and anger, without fear. So this is the first thing, how mindfulness works together with compassion. To relax your body, to heal your body, to make you healthier. Now the next thing we use mindfulness towards is even to our mind when we meditate, to be able to relax the mental world. Just like you relax the body, you can relax the mind as well. The same technique works. That technique is being aware of your mental world. You know how stressed you are. You know how peaceful you are, or the opposite of peaceful, how restlessness you are. That's very easy to know. How do you move that restlessness into more peace? How do you move tiredness into more energy? The mindfulness gives you the feedback, and once again you'll find the key ingredient is kindness. When you're kind, you don't put so many demands on your poor mental world. You let it be. That's what compassion is. You know that my famous description of compassion coming from that story which gave rise to the title of Opening the Door of Your Heart, when my father took me aside one afternoon, I was only about 13, and said, "Son, wherever you go in your life, however you turn out, the door of my house will always be open to you." I realized he meant his heart. The most important words were, "Whatever I do, however I turn out." It was unconditional love. That meant so much to me. To open the door of my heart to other people, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, you'll always be my friend. It's a beautiful act of love. Now that is how I practice in my meditation as well. When I'm sitting there, I say to my mind, "Mind, the door of my heart is totally open to you. Even if you're crazy, even if you're asleep, even if you're restless, even if you're thinking the most unmonkish types of thoughts, it's all right. I still love you, mind." That's called compassion. And it's amazing how powerful that works.
And I'm telling you this because if you understand how to add compassion in your meditation, the meditation gets so easy. There's no longer any struggle. And you get very, very peaceful very quickly. So what do I mean by that? A story about my life as a monk many years ago. When I got to my 6th year as a monk, I was allowed to go off by myself and seek solitude. But when it comes to the Was season, that's the rainy season retreat, we all have to find a monastery somewhere to stay in. And I discovered the perfect monastery for an English monk. It was in the middle of a tea plantation. The best place for an English monk. Because, you know, we monks like our tea. You know, that's one of the reasons why I became a disciple of Ajahn Chah. Anyone whose name was Tea was my master. Because Cha means tea in Thai, and in many other languages as well. So, I found this beautiful monastery in the middle of a tea plantation. It was abandoned. There was no one staying there. And I didn't need to do anything. There's hardly any maintenance. There's a tiny bit of sweeping, that's all. And the villagers up in the north of Thailand, this was high up in the mountains. The villagers, all they wanted to do was to feed me. They never wanted to learn about meditation. That suited me because too many questions on meditation. And too many other questions as well. Very close by was another monastery. Actually, this was a monastery I tried to stay in before I found this monastery up in the mountains. In this other monastery, which was again in the north of Thailand, it had lovely caves, and I really like meditating in caves. It's a beautiful place to meditate. And everything was going very well until it came to Waisak Day. And on Waisak Day, all these villagers came to the monastery. You know, because it's, you know, what you do on Waisak Day. And they were bored with the abbot's sermon. So they came to see me, because I was Western monk. They'd never seen Western monk before. So they came up to me to talk to me. And they came up and said, "Where do you come from? Why did you become a monk? What does your father do? And your mother? And how many brothers and sisters have you got?" And when I told them that, then the next person came up. "Why did you become a monk? How many brothers and sisters have you got?" After about 30 times of being asked the same question, I got really fed up. They weren't asking anything interesting about meditation or about Four Noble Truths. All they wanted to find out was what my father does, what my mother does, and how many brothers and sisters I've got. So when I got really fed up, now as a monk you've got your little tricks of escaping. The main trick to escape is to say, "I need to go toilet." You always need to go toilet. So I said, "I want to go to toilet." You know, the other trick, I shouldn't tell you this, the other trick is when you give me an invitation, you know, it's very hard to say no. If I say no, you get upset. So these days when you say, "Can you please come back to the Mahavihara?" I don't say no, I'll say, "I'll think about it." You know, there's many invitations I got years ago. I'm still thinking about it. Because it's not lying. You've got to be very careful as a monk. You're not allowed to lie. So I'm thinking about it. That means no. But it doesn't upset people. So I couldn't say, "You know, I'm fed up with you. Get out of here. You know, I'm a monk. You're not allowed to say what you think." Or you. So instead, I said, "I want to go to the toilet." So they let me go to the toilet. And as soon as I finished going to the toilet, I got outside the toilet door, looked left, looked right. No one was watching me. So I ran to my hut. And I got a flashlight, a torch, some water, and a cushion. And I went into one of the caves without anyone seeing me. one of the deepest caves in the area, maybe 100 meters deep. And it went all around, many sort of turns and twists in this cave. And I knew there was good air in the bottom. I'd been there before. So now I could have some peace and quiet and meditate. And I was so proud of myself escaping from all these people. And when I got to the end of the cave, you know, I put my... it was dark. I turned off the flashlight. I put down my cushion, crossed my legs. I had the water in case I was thirsty later on, and started meditating. Oh, it was so peaceful for about 3 minutes. And then I heard a sound. Someone was coming in to my cave. And by the sound of it, it wasn't one person. It was many people. I found out later that the villagers, they were also so bored with the sermon from their monks. They too, and they couldn't find a Western monk to waste their time in. So they decided to explore the caves. And they started exploring my cave. Really unfair. But I still had a chance. I had one chance. Because I saw there was a corner, a bend in the chamber of the cave. And I saw them getting closer and closer because the light from their lantern got lighter and lighter. And then one of these Thai villagers, they turned the corner. And in the light from their lamp, they saw me sitting at the end of the cave. I was very still. And they quickly went back. They were frightened. And I heard them talking to each other. I understood Thai perfectly. And they said, "There's a ghost at the end of the cave. I just saw a ghost at the end of the cave." I said, "Very good." Because Thais are terrified of ghosts. "Let's get out of here. There's a ghost." And the other man said, "There can't be a ghost." "Yes, there is a ghost. Let's get out." "No, there can't be." "Yeah, there is. Get out quick." I thought, "Yeah, get out. Go on." And then two heads came round the corner to have a look at me. And then they came back. "It's not a ghost. It's a Western monk." Oh, no. So about 10 people, they came up to me. And they asked me, "What does your father do?" "How many brothers and sisters have you got?" Oh, you just can't escape. It's really unfair. But in this monastery I went to, I did escape. I went to another monastery where the villagers didn't want to ask me anything, just to feed me and left me alone all day. It was a perfect place to meditate. The traffic was one car once a week. And you had to be looking in the direction to see it. It came up to bring the post, and anything which needed to be sent down took them down to the valley below. That's the traffic, one car a week. It was the idyllic place to meditate. The trouble was, after a week or two, my mind started getting restless. I couldn't stop it thinking. When I tried to stop it thinking, it got worse. And the embarrassing thing was, I started thinking non-monkish thoughts about old girlfriends, about romance, about sex. And I was a monk. I didn't want to think these things. But they kept coming into my mind with more and more force. And it was such a battle. "Get out. I don't want to think these things. I'm a monk." But she was a very nice girl. "Shut up. You're still young." "Yeah, I don't want to become a monk. I don't want to become a lay person. I'm a monk." "But you know, there's many people out there. It may be your soulmate. She's waiting for you out there somewhere. Shut up, I want to be a monk." It was such a battle for me. The worst thing was, I didn't have anybody to talk to, because I was by myself in this monastery. And one day it got so bad, I thought I was going crazy with all these thoughts, that I went to the main shrine. There was a Buddha statue there. Now, I was not a superstitious monk. But when you're desperate, you'll try anything. And I asked the Buddha for help. Amazing thing happened. An idea came up. A possible solution. And my strategy was, do a deal. I was a Westerner. You know, we do deals. And the bargain was, I said to my mind, okay, if you want to think those sexual fantasies, romance, old girlfriends, I will allow you to do that for 1 hour a day. From 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every afternoon. You can think whatever you want. And I won't try and stop you. The rest of the time you behave. You watch your breath. That sounded fair to me. So, having made that resolution in front of the Buddha, when I make a resolution, a promise, I keep it. I made that resolution in front of the Buddha. I'd allow myself to think anything from 3 to 4. The rest of the time, my mind would behave. It was still a struggle. I tried to watch my breath, breathing in, breathing out, and this thought would come into my mind about girls and romance. It was so tough. And I was fighting all day. And by 3 o'clock, I was so tired. I went up to my hut, leant against the wall, and said, okay, now I'm not going to fight you anymore. You can think anything you like. Anything about girls, romance, marriage, sex, I don't care. Off you go. And for the next hour, my mind watched every breath without missing one. It was so peaceful. And that's true. It really shocked me. But I found out that because I was fighting my mind, that's why all those thoughts were coming in. My anger, my negativity was feeding them. And as soon as I was kind to my mind, you can think whatever you want, then my mind became peaceful. That was one of the first times I realized where your wandering mind comes from. Because you fight it. Please don't fight. Be kind. Be compassionate. There you are, mind. If you want to think, it's all right by me. I love you, mind. The door of my heart is open to you, mind. Even if you think the most stupid of thoughts, it's all right. Ajahn Brahm loves you. Now that is what makes you relax and be peaceful. Even how many of you were tired today? I was very sleepy today. That's why at 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock, instead of coming down here to meditate with you, I had a rest in my room. I was tired. I was kind to. I'm getting old now. I'm wearing out. I'm old before my time. No, I've still got very good. But when I'm tired, I'm kind enough to give myself a break. That means you get energy. I don't fight anymore. Is Buddhism a violent religion? It's a kind religion, compassionate. So if you feel sleepy, go to sleep. You deserve it, poor thing. But when you don't fight, you find the sleepiness disappears. Think about it. Where does all of that tiredness come from? Lack of energy. And how do we fight that lack of energy? We fight and waste more energy on the battle. Instead, we're just kind and let it be. And then all the energy comes back. Because after a while you will get the insight that there are two parts to the mind. Two halves of the mind. The first half is the very active part of the mind. That is the thinker, the controller, the one which makes all the decisions, the thing which fights. I think you all know that, the active part of the mind called the doer. The other half of the mind is just the passive part. That part which can hear what I'm saying, which can feel the body, which knows what you're thinking. The knower. Now when you understand what I mean by the doer and the knower, you may understand that most of your energy, most of your mental energy goes into doing things. You're so active, so thinking, so much planning and remembering, you do so much, that is the reason you get tired. And when you're tired, we try and fight the mind, we waste that energy. So instead, if you're tired, be kind to it, let it be. Open the door of your heart to your tiredness. It's okay, mind, be tired. Because you don't fight it, the natural energy you have starts flowing into your mindfulness. The mindfulness starts to wake up and get stronger. It is stillness, not fighting, but stillness, energizes your mindfulness. You literally wake up. And this gives you an understanding of the path of meditation and the path to enlightenment. Stillness means you're not wasting mental energy. And the energy goes into mindfulness. You literally wake up. You know what the word Buddha means? It comes from the Pali word bujjhati, to wake up. It's much more accurate to translate the word Buddha as the awakened one, rather than the enlightened one. The mindfulness wakes up. You're alive again. The sloth and torpor vanishes. But not just vanishes. What happens next is the mindfulness starts to get stronger and stronger as all the energy goes into knowing. You literally get more and more mindful. There's not just mindfulness and lack of mindfulness. I coined the term power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. Because once you get into this meditation, being still, you free up all this energy to go into mindfulness. It gets more and more strong and powerful. Like turning on the lights, up the lights in this room. As the intensity of the illumination gets more and more powerful, you can see more and more things. This is why mindfulness, when it gets empowered through stillness, you can see more and more of what's going on. And what you see becomes more and more beautiful. This is one of the classic stories to explain why that stillness creates strong mindfulness so you can get more insight and also more happiness. Because all these things go together. This was a story of the monastery where I live in Australia, which is on top of a hill. As I often say, the reason why in Australia we look for a hill or a mountain for our monastery was because of tradition. All holy men in the West are supposed to live on top of mountains. We couldn't find a mountain, so a hill would do. You never hear of a holy man living in a swamp. They live on top of mountains. It's tradition. Except there's one exception. There's one holy man who lives in a swamp. And who's that? Yoda. Yoda from Star Wars, the J.D. Knight. He lives in a swamp. But that's Hollywood. That's not real life. So we found a mountain and we built our monastery on top of the hill. Now, for about 7 years, I travelled to and from that monastery, up and down that hill, in a car. And it took about 7 years, when one day I was coming back from an appointment, I had plenty of time, it was a lovely spring afternoon, and so I told the driver of the car, let me out of the bottom, I want to walk. I'll meet you at the top later on. It's only about 2.5 kilometers. So for the first time in 7 years, I walked up the road at the end of which I lived. I never walked up there before. And a strange thing happened. I couldn't recognize my surroundings. It was so different than what I remember through the window of a car. And it was such a strange experience, not being able to recognize my surroundings, seeing things I never noticed before, that I stopped and stood still. And when I stood still, the scenery changed again. I started to see things I never imagined existed in that hillside. Little flowers and rocks and little saplings growing out from the grass. I noticed so much more detail. And I also, everything became so much brighter. You know, the greens of the grass were deeper, you know, richer in color. And the browns and the grays of the tree bark and the rocks, as if they were all illuminated. And the whole thing was so beautiful. I'd never seen that hillside so gorgeous before. And it was so wonderful. I spent 5 or 10 minutes just looking, and then realized I had to get back to the monastery, so I started walking up. But I started thinking, what's going on? Why has I only just started seeing that hillside and how beautiful it is? Did somebody put some magic mushrooms in my lunch today? What was happening? Because that's what it felt like. Sometimes on drugs or something. But then I started contemplating. No one put any drugs in our food. You've got to be very careful as a monk, because I don't know what you put in our food. You've got to be very careful what you put in sometimes. Especially there was in Australia, there was a Chinese society, and they did put mushrooms in the curry, and many people got killed. And the day afterwards, somebody gave me mushroom soup. And I said, no, thank you. I don't want to do that today. I don't know if you heard that story of that man. You know, his fourth wife had just, no, it was his fourth wife had just died. And the police suspected him because, you know, she died of a broken neck. And they looked at his record. His first three wives had also died. So they asked him in the interrogation room. It says here your first wife died of mushroom poisoning. And your second wife also died of mushroom poisoning. And so did your third wife. But your fourth wife died of a broken neck. Why did that happen? And the man said, because she wouldn't eat her mushrooms. That's an old joke, but I love that one. Anyway, so why is that monastery looking so, that land looking so wonderful? I started thinking about that as a scientist. It wasn't any drugs or any substances at all. It was just science. When you look through the window of a speeding car, the light does not have enough time to form an image on the back of your eye, on the retina, before another image comes in, dislodges the first, and then another image, and then another image. Remember, the way you see, it's a chemical reaction on the back of your eye, on the retina. When you see one image after another in rapid succession, the images do not properly form and the colors aren't rich. When you get out of the car and walk, your eyes have more time. So more of what's out there is registered on the back of your eye. And the colors are richer. They've got more time to develop. But nothing beats standing still and just allowing the image to fully form. Only then does all the detail start to emerge and all the colors become rich as they should be, because that's what's out there. All it was is just knowing how your physical senses work. And that shocked me, because I realized that most of people's lives are experienced like looking through the window of a speeding car. We go so fast that whether it's sounds or tastes or sights or feelings, they don't fully form before another sound comes into our ears. We don't have enough time for it to fully manifest in its depth and beauty. But when you start going slow, not only do you see much more, you see more deeply, and everything becomes more beautiful. It's not only the scenery, it's the food. The more deep you get in meditation, the slower you go, the more you can taste in the food that you eat. This experience was from my first meditation retreat I did when I was only 19 years of age. Our little Buddhist group hired 3 boarding houses in the town of Cambridge. It was a university group in 1970. Could have been 71. I think it was 71. And for those of you who have ever been to England in the late 60s and early 70s, it can be a very beautiful country to visit. But the worst part of English culture at that time was the food. The food was disgusting. It used to be what we used to call meat and 2 vegetables. It didn't matter what the vegetables were, because they boiled all the taste out of them, they all tasted exactly the same. There was no taste left. So everything was tasteless. That was English cooking. French knew how to cook, Chinese knew how to cook, but the English didn't. And the worst, the bottom of the pile of cooks in the whole country were those employed to cook for poor students. And that's the cook I was going to have to eat from for 9 days. I really thought of bringing my own sandwiches or something, because the food would be disgusting. Boarding house cooking in 1971. But, to my great surprise, the food was delicious. At the time I thought I'd just been lucky to get a good cook. It was nothing to do with the cook. Everything to do with my meditation. Because my mindfulness was so powerful, was so strong, that the tiniest bit of taste left after all that boiling, I could pick up. I was so sensitive, you could taste that food. Now, if that's what happens with English boarding house cooking, imagine what it's like, you know, with nice Malaysian cuisine. Or from Penang, which is very famous for its cooking. Or even Malacca, where many Singaporeans like to go to eat. I say that because a couple of years ago, there was a ceremony at a Sek Ye In temple in Malacca. They were celebrating something or other, and they invited me to go over to give some talks. I gave some talks. They finished about 10 o'clock. And some of my disciples, they got a bus from Singapore and went over for the weekend. And after the talk finished at 10 o'clock, did these Singaporeans go to bed? No. They went out to the restaurants to eat. And they ate so long that when they came back to the temple where they were staying, the gate was locked. Some of them had climbed in. They climbed over the gate late in the middle of the night. And others, they had to wake up the president at midnight to get locked. What were you doing eating that late at night? This culture, tradition. Because they love Malaccan food. But if you meditate, it tastes even more delicious. Because everything you taste or you see or you feel, your mindfulness is so strong. You can feel it much more deeply. And I have to tell, this is one of my favorite stories. It's a bit disgusting, but it is true. I was doing this retreat. This was over in Perth. And my meditation is very deep. I was getting this incredible, powerful mindfulness. Everything you saw was so beautiful. The flowers, they were just like, they were polished. The colors were like fluorescent. That's what happens when your mindfulness gets strong. And the reason I left the meditation, I was having such a wonderful time, I needed to go to the toilet. So I went to the toilet, and I just happened, after going to the toilet, to look in the toilet bowl. Wow! Look at that! I've never seen such beautiful browns before. And the way the water lies on the surface, it makes it twinkle like a diamond. And this fragrance, oh, that's so rich and deep. In my whole life, I've never seen a piece of feces so beautiful before. Because when you have superpower mindfulness, even that looks beautiful and fragrant. For a few moments, I thought of fishing it out of the bowl and taking it back to show people. But I realized, no, you're a monk, you have to let it go. Oh, that was hard. I had to press, no, I can't press, no, you have to press the button. No, I pressed the button and it went away. Oh, that's a true story. Now, if a piece of excrement looks so beautiful when you have superpower mindfulness, imagine what other things look like. You get so much happiness. That's how depression vanishes. You just can't be depressed for weeks, for years afterwards. The reason why modern people get depressed, and what all depression is a very low level of mindfulness. Your mindfulness is so weak, you can't taste anything. All the food tastes the same, bland. All the colors are all washed out. As if somebody's put, you know, your red shirt through the laundry and all the colors leached out. Even the sounds, nothing sounds good. Because you've got such a low level of mindfulness, it's like living life in a dark room. Nothing stands out. And the way to overcome that depression is not fighting it. Not getting negative about the depression. Just letting it be. Opening the door of your heart to being depressed. Compassion. And because you're not fighting, the energy comes back into your mind, into the knower. Your mindfulness gets stronger. The lights in your head get stronger. You start to taste delicious flavors. You start to feel more deeply. And the colors start to become brighter. Simply because your mind is getting its energy back. That's all it takes. That's why one of the reasons there is so much depression in our modern world is because people work so hard, they get tired, they use up too much mental energy until they've got none left. That's the first reason for depression, because we work too hard, we rest too little. Number two is we strive too hard. We struggle and struggle and struggle until we get frustrated. And whenever you get frustrated, most people try even harder. You really put huge efforts in to fighting this obstacle to what you want to achieve. Then you get angry. After frustration comes anger. And anger sucks up so much of your energy, you usually get into the next stage, depression. I've seen that in many people. Struggling, frustration, anger, next stage, depression. Don't follow that path. Instead, we're more kind, more loose, more easygoing. You don't get depressed that way, because you preserve your mental energy. But if you do get depressed, please don't fight it. Make peace, have compassion, and you find the energy comes back naturally. And when it does, you're mindful. And when it does, life becomes more enjoyable. With the powerful mindfulness, you also get more happiness. It always comes together. That is what I said this afternoon. The Buddha said, people who meditate properly, look happier. They are happier simply because they've got more mental energy. That's why your mindfulness is increasing. And that is a wonderful thing for Buddhists to learn how to be powerfully mindful, even superpower mindfulness. So not only do they see more in life, they're not just looking through life through the window of a fast car and thinking they know what's going on. You start to see much more beauty and appreciate much more in life. Number one, if you have a good meditation retreat or good meditation time, when you go home, your wife looks far more beautiful. Darling, have you been to spa? Have you been to a salon? No, I was exactly the same as when I left. But your eyes are much more empowered. You can see her beauty. And your husband looks far more cute. It was always like that, but your senses have been empowered by mindfulness, which means you appreciate each other more. It's really weird being a monk, because, you know, I know a lot of you. You're such wonderful people. And I think, people come to me and they say, we can't live together, we're thinking of getting divorced. So what are you getting divorced for? You're just a wonderful girl. You're so beautiful and kind. And he's such a wonderful man. I've known him for years. He's so sensitive and good. How come you can't live with each other? When I see you, you're wonderful people. But you can't see each other through my eyes because you're too tired. So giving yourself a little bit of relaxation and peace, you start to appreciate the beauty in the people you live with. Like I appreciated the beauty in that road where I'd been traveling up and down for 7 years. More importantly, with that mindfulness and that compassion, you start to appreciate the beauty in yourself. Ajahn Brahmi, not that bad after all. Even though sometimes I tell the most stupid of jokes. You know the most stupid joke I've been telling people for the last few weeks. It's a very un-Buddhist joke, but here it comes. I can't stop myself. It's just my character. It's about the cat who died. This poor cat, you know cats have 9 lives? But this cat got hit by a truck with 18 wheels. Boom, 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 8, boom, 9, gone. That's really a ridiculous joke for a Buddhist monk to teach. But nevertheless, it's funny. So, but I've got even funnier joke than that. Because last couple of weeks ago, when I was in Singapore, I went into Changi Jail. In Section A, that's where the tough prisoners are. There's a little Buddhist group. And these are the ones in there for 35, 40, 50 years. Very sad to see them. And I did teach them some Buddhism, I did teach them some meditation, but I thought the one thing you don't hear in prison is a nice joke. So I told them the joke, the story about the bear, the rabbit, and the magic duck. Because once there was a bear and a rabbit living in the forest. And they would always chase each other, usually the bear chasing the rabbit. And one day they were chasing each other just by the lake where the magic duck lived. And the magic duck said, look, stop destroying the peace and tranquility of this forest. Stop it, you two. Stop chasing each other. Look, said the magic duck, if you agree to stop chasing each other, I will give you 3 wishes each. And the bear looked at the duck. So the bear looked at the rabbit, and the rabbit looked at the bear. And they nodded in agreement. Okay, if you give us 3 wishes, we'll stop chasing each other. So, Mr. Bear, what's your first wish? And Mr. Bear, being a male, said, "For my first wish, I want all the other bears in this forest all to be female. So I'm the only boy. That way I get no competition." You know what it's like, guys, being a guy? All the competition for the girls? So Mr. Bear said, "I wish I'm the only male and all the other bears in this forest are all female." "Quack," said the magic duck. And at that quack, all the bears in the whole forest were female. He was the only male bear. He thought, "Wow, this is going to be fun." And then they asked the rabbit for his first wish. And the rabbit said, "I want a crash helmet." And the duck said, "What do you want a crash helmet for?" "None of your business," said the rabbit. "You gave me a wish. Now grant it, otherwise we'll start chasing each other again." "Okay," said the magic duck. Quack. And his motorcycle crash helmet appeared on the rabbit's head. "Mr. Bear, what's your second wish?" And Mr. Bear said, "I've been thinking. When all the other bears in the country hear that in this forest is only girls, they'll migrate here and spoil my fun. So my second wish is, may all the bears in the whole country be female, and I'm the only male bear in the whole country." Quack. And magically, all the bears in the whole country were female, and he was the only male bear. "What's your second wish, rabbit?" And the rabbit said, "I want a 1,000cc Harley Davidson motorcycle to go with my crash helmet." "Okay," said the duck, "I can understand that wish." Quack. And this beautiful, gleaming Harley Davidson appeared. And the rabbit got on top of the Harley and started revving her up. Vroom, 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 with his crash helmet on. And the time for the bear's third wish. "Okay, Mr. Bear, what's your third and final wish?" And Mr. Bear said, "Look, I should have thought about this at the beginning. But when all the bears on other countries overseas, when they hear there's only female bears in this country, they'll all find a way of getting over here. They will spoil my fun. So my third and final wish is all the bears in the whole world, they're all female except me. I'm the only male bear." A man's dream. He can choose whichever girl he wants. "Okay," said the duck, quack. And all the bears in the whole world were female. He was the only male bear. And he was grinning in happiness. And then they asked the rabbit, "What's your third wish?" And the rabbit on his Harley Davidson, revving up for a quick getaway, "My third wish is that Mr. Bear becomes gay." And he serves him right. Too much lust. So the prisoners, they hadn't laughed like that for years inside Changi Jail. So anyway, that's what mindfulness does. It makes everything beautiful, everything happy, and later on it also gives you great insight. So remember, the stillness leads to great mindfulness. And the mindfulness can feel your body, can feel the mental world, and through compassion can learn how to relax so much that sicknesses, and especially emotional sicknesses, you can become free from. Anger, grief, especially anxiety and fear, you know how to deal with them. You can feel them. Just relax them, and it all disappears. It's like I could feel that food poisoning. Just relax with so much compassion. 20 minutes and it was all gone. It's amazing what you can do with mindfulness together with compassion. And I must admit that that rabbit had no compassion for the bear. Okay. So I've got a couple of questions from early this afternoon. I'm going to read them out now because it's 8:15. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you were saying, for example, abuse is a kind of forward mistake so it can help one become wiser in the future. I didn't say that. I said failure. But what if Mrs. A has a forward mistake, but Mrs. B doesn't have a forward mistake? Does that mean Mrs. B is less fortunate, doesn't have a chance to gain the forward mistake, or Mrs. B is so blessed for her entire life that she doesn't have a forward mistake? Which option is better? The option is, can you please explain that question? I don't really understand it. But it doesn't matter. Whoever wrote that made a mistake. You learn to make the question more sort of clear next time. So it's forward failing. So it's not abuse. It's when we make a mistake, when I make a mistake, I say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. You learn from that. And that's called forward failing. So it's your mistakes in life is what we used to learn. Now you have, how do I get rid of my perfectionism? It causes a lot of disappointment in daily life. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. You're awesome. Yeah, I'm awesome. So cool. So anyway, no, be a perfectionist, but understand what perfection truly is. How many of you have ever got into the forest for a nice walk? When you go into the forest, have you ever seen a tree which is perfectly straight, with all its branches evenly spaced, and all the leaves in perfect order on the tree, and all the trees in nice rows and lines? Only in plantation do you see that. Yeah. In real life, the trees are all over the place, leading this way and that way. That's what makes it beautiful. If everything was in rows and lines, it would not be nature, it would not be beautiful. Where I live in Western Australia, that mountain faces west, overlooking the Indian Ocean. And sometimes we get such beautiful sunsets only when there's a bit of cloud or dust in the sky. Because the cloud or the dust spreads the light. It spreads the golds and crimsons and purples all across the horizon. And some of those golden crimson sunsets are glorious. Only if there's some imperfection in the atmosphere. When there's no clouds, there's no dust, you see the sun go down, but it doesn't spread the light. You need imperfection for things to be beautiful. 200 years ago, women used to put beauty spots on their face as part of their makeup. Imperfections to show how beautiful they really were. This is so important. Without an imperfection, you're not beautiful anymore. You are plastic. Unnatural, not real. Somebody noticed once, one of our monks gave a talk, it became a classic talk, because he'd had to go to the dentist that afternoon. And while waiting to go into the dentist surgery, he was looking at these magazines. These fashion magazines with these beautiful girls on the cover and inside. And when he went to the temple to give a talk, he said, "Why aren't any of you girls like that?" And the reason is, those perfect girls you see on the cover, it's all makeup and airbrushing. Real girls aren't like that. And you girls say, "Why aren't you like Brad Pitt?" Even Brad Pitt is not like Brad Pitt. That's only when they have a double and they airbrush everything and they put the makeup on before he does his scenes. Have you ever noticed after he fights, his hair is always perfect? In real fights, that never happens. You get bruised, you get very ugly. But not in Hollywood. It's crazy. But real people sweat. Real people, their hair is all over the place. Except for monks. My hair is always perfect. Real people are imperfect. Life is imperfect. Actually, that is perfect. Once you understand what perfection really is, you change your idea of what perfection is. And so your wife is perfect. You are perfect. Life is perfect. With all its faults, your concept of perfection changes. And then you find you have no disappointment in life. When I was school teacher, I had to set my first examination in mathematics. I never set a test before. So I went to ask one of my fellow teachers, how do you set a test? And they gave me this wonderful advice. Set the test so the average score is about 70%. Make it not too difficult, but not too easy. And if the results are 70%, that's the best possible test. Because if you set it too hard, and your students, your children only get 4 or 5, they will get so disappointed, they will think they cannot do maths. And they'll give up. They'll lose their motivation if it's too hard. If it's too easy, and they all get 9 or 10, it's such an easy test that it's not worth doing. But if the average score is 7 out of 10, that will mean they will all get encouraged and motivated. It's a good score, 7 out of 10. So you encourage them. Yes, they can do maths. But also, that 30% where they make mistakes, that's where I, as their teacher, can find out their weak points. So in the next lessons, I can address those weak points. That's where they will learn from the 30% where they make mistakes. The 70% is where they get encouragement from. And I realize that that's the perfect life. If 70% happiness and 30% suffering. Because that 30% disappointment, that's where you learn. That's where you grow. If your life was always 95%, 100%, always being successful, never failing at all, you would never learn anything from life. If your life was 30% success and 70% failure, you would get depressed and fed up, thinking you're hopeless. 70% is the perfect score for life. Now you know what perfection is. 70%, not 100%, but 70%. Encouragement, but also learning. So when you know that perfectionism is not 100%, but 70%, then you'll never get frustrated or disappointed. You know that this is the meaning of life. In yesterday's Dharma talk on clinging and letting go, your reverence mentioned about a loving couple, and one of them was terminally ill and suffering, and your reverence, out of compassion, asked the terminally ill person to let go to prevent suffering for both parties. I never did that. You weren't listening. What I said is I asked the wife of the boy who was dying, have you given your husband permission to go? And it was the wife who went up on the bed and told her husband, I give you permission to die. I love you so much. Don't try too hard to stay. It was the wife did that. But the question here is, does Buddhism advocate mercy killing or euthanasia, assuming the person is on life support? If so, does this not contradict the primary precept of not killing? Of course it does. So Buddhism, we don't give anybody the right to kill other people. But if you want to do that yourself, it is your choice. We all have the choice of when we want to die. And I say this because sometimes people ask me the question, very common question, what should you do when your mother or father is in the hospital on life support and the doctors ask you, should I turn off the life support? And you, usually the senior son, has to make that decision. That's a very tough decision to make. What should you do? If you say keep the life support going, you might think that's going to cost a lot of money and it's not worth it. And you're keeping that bed from another person who may need it more than your mother or father. But if you say to the doctor, turn off the life support, you're killing your mum and dad. That's terrible. So what should you do? Here is the Buddhist answer. If you touch your mother or father on life support in a coma, you go to their bedside and you ask your mum what she wants to do. But she's in a coma. Yes, she's in a coma. But if she's still there, you will feel intuitively whether she wants to go or doesn't want to go. It's up to her. This happened some years ago. There was a young Thai girl who came to see me. She was a reporter. And she asked me that same question about, you know, euthanasia. And I told her, I said, well, suppose your mother's in a coma on life support and you have to decide whether to shut off the machine or not. Her jaw dropped and said, you're good, because her mother was in hospital in a coma on life support. Sometimes you pick these things up. And I told her that. And so she did exactly that. She was by her mother's bedside. She asked her mum, how are you? Are you still there? Do you want to go yet? The mother said no. She felt that. She was the daughter. If you're that daughter, that's your loved one, you know inside of you what your mother wants to do. Later on, I visited that mother in the hospital. I sat bedside myself and I asked that same question. Even though that wasn't my mother, I've got a strong enough mind just to know that she'd had enough. She was tired. She had, it was the Creutz-Jakobsen disease, you know what they call mad cow disease. She'd eaten some sort of meat which is infected and half her brain was jelly. She had been fighting that for a couple of years and I got the very clear message, she was tired. But I said, you ask your mum too. And the two sisters got the same message. And the next day, the mother died. They didn't need to turn off the machine. The mother died herself. And they were so impressed that I did the funeral service for them the next day. And that girl is now a bhikkhuni in Perth. This is actually what happens. If that is, say, a dog or a cat, that's your pet, and it gets some cancer, as a Buddhist, what should you do? Should you take it to the vet and kill it? You call it putting it down, but it's killing it. So the answer is, you have no right to kill that dog. It's the dog's choice. Ask the dog. One woof for yes, two woofs for no. No, no, you don't do that. You don't need to do that. Look that dog in the eye and ask the question, have you had enough? Do you want to die? If that's the dog you love and care for, you will know straight away. Judy, over in Perth, as many people have done that, this little answer, she had a dog with cancer in its legs. She treated it for so long, nothing seemed to work, it was getting worse. So when she took it to the vet said, look, it's going to get much worse, it's time to put your dog down, to euthanize it. And because she was my disciple, she said, give me a few minutes with my dog. So she took the dog into a corner, looked into the dog's eyes, and asked the question, do you want to go? Have you had enough? It's the dog's decision, not yours. And very clear, the message came back, no, the dog didn't want to die yet. So she took it back to the vet and said, no, I'm taking the dog home. And the vet got very angry. Your dog is dying. We can't do anything about it. You're just giving your pet more pain. He said, no, I'm taking it home. You Buddhists are so stupid and so cruel. Now, trying to preserve life at all costs, even though you're hurting your animal. Let the experts decide. No, I'm taking it home. So she took her dog home, even though the vet thought she was a very bad girl and Buddhism was stupid. 6 months later, she took the dog back to the vet because the dog had made 100% recovery. And the vet couldn't believe it. Wow, you Buddhists are so wise. The dog knew what was going on. The dog realized it still had a chance. It was the dog's decision. So that's why we never take that decision away. It's your mother in a coma. She's the one who decides, not you. It's the dog decides, not you. So you ask the question, you look into your cat's eyes, ask the question, you'll know straight away. If you take it to the vet and ask it to be put down, you're not killing the dog or the cat. You're just conveying the dog's wishes to the vet. When is compassion stupid compassion? It is stupid compassion when there's no mindfulness or awareness there at all. For example, sometimes you're so compassionate to me that you offer me more food to eat in the morning. Yeah, it's compassionate, but it's not wise because it makes me fat. It's your fault. And that happens sometimes, even this morning. I'd finished my breakfast, and one of the workers in the kitchen, I won't say who, made me a hopper with an omelette on it, with an egg on it. And it was hot. She made it specially for me. So I couldn't stop but eating it. Otherwise, I'd really upset her. It was her compassion, but it wasn't very wise. I ate too much this morning. So remember, compassion is also being sensitive. It's not just being compassionate, it's seeing what needs to be done and doing it. What is your view on the recent debate in Thailand about the position of homosexual and transgender persons being monks? There are a number of very successful monks I know, senior monks, they're actually not at my temple anymore, who were gay, were homosexual. I won't say who they are, but some of you know these monks, and they're very, very good monks. The point is that once you become a monk, you stop practicing homosexuality. That's why you become a monk. I'm heterosexual. Before I was a monk, now I am celibate. So it's okay a homosexual or a heterosexual becoming a monk, but once they become a monk, no homosexuality, no heterosexuality. You're celibate. Which is why in Thailand there are three genders. Male, female and monks. Including us as well. You know, we're something different. Totally different than other people. That's why I always think in the toilets in the airport they should have male, female and monks. Because it gets very confusing. I travel around the world a lot. And in some countries, they write the signs, they don't write it in English. It might be in Chinese, in Arabic. And I have to look at the picture to find out which is the male toilet and the female toilet. When I look at the picture and I look at what I'm wearing, I go into the wrong toilet. No, I've never done that, but came close a few times. So that's why, yes, it's okay, a gay person, a heterosexual can become a monk, because once they become a monk, they're not gay anymore. They're not heterosexual anymore, they're celibate. They enter the third sex. What is the right speech to speak to someone who is diagnosed as terminally illness? And when the person or whole family is badly affected emotionally, what to say and what not to say, how to calm the person and the family instead. When I was very sick in hospital with typhus fever for about 3 weeks, I really felt terrible. Third world hospital, Ajahn Chah came to see me. This is how you should teach people who've got a terminal sickness, or any sickness for that matter. Ajahn Chah came to my bedside. I felt terrible before, but when you saw your great and famous master coming to visit you, all that really raised my spirits. Until he opened his mouth, and what he told me, he said, Brahma Wangso, you're either going to get better or you'll die. And then he left. That's all he said. His bedside manner wasn't that good. But his wisdom was spot on. It's true. So tell the person who's dying, you're going to get better or you're going to die. That's true, isn't it? You can't. So either way, your illness is not going to last. That's a nice thing to know. So if they're terminally ill, I've known many people terminally ill. And they've lasted 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So the doctor doesn't know it, just the chances are you're going to die. So if they're diagnosed as terminal illness, tell them the story of the two people who died and went up to heaven with the mansion, the toilet with Chanel number 5, the Ferrari sports car and the golf course. And they say, wow, you lucky thing, you're terminally ill. You're going on holiday soon. Well, if you're going on vacation overseas, this magnificent vacation, say you're going to, where's a nice place? The Maldive Islands. Say you're going to the Bahamas. Say you're going to London for a first-class holiday. Wouldn't you be counting the days until you go? Wouldn't you get excited the closer it comes to your holiday? Wouldn't the night before you were about to go on holiday, you would hardly sleep because of excitement and anticipation? Imagine going to heaven. That's much better than going to London. You're terminally ill. Only 12 days to go. 11, yes, yes, yes. 10 days to go. Oh, it's so exciting. I'm going to die soon. Why not? People are really stupid. Because they're afraid of dying. Where many people should be afraid of living. That is more dangerous than dying. Why do you think it is? Have you been to funeral services? Have you seen the corpse? Have you ever noticed the dead person is always smiling? While everyone else is crying? Have you ever seen what happens when a baby gets born? The baby cries and everyone else is smiling. We get it the wrong way around. When the baby cries, it's being born, you should cry as well. Oh, that poor kid, so much suffering. When they die, you should be happy like the person in the box. They're smiling, you should smile too. We get it the wrong way around. So anyway, the best thing to do when they're terminally ill, give each other permission to depart, give the terminally ill person permission to die and care for them. You can't cure, but you can always care, and the caring is the most important thing in life. When we register for a retreat, 8 precepts, we were told to wear white. But during the retreat, 8 precepts, there are many who dress up so colourful and some even in black. Is it necessary to dress in white? White is a symbol of purity, which is why in a wedding the bride always wears white. It's a symbol of her purity. So why does the groom wear black? What's that a symbol of? No. It's, if you can wear white, that's very, very good. But you don't have to wear white. White just shows you're pure on the outside. It's what's on the inside is most important. If you can wear white, fine. If you haven't got white, you can wear whatever you've got. Not clinging and ignorant. What are the differences? Okay. It's not ignorant, it's deluded. So deluded people cling, and clinging causes delusion. So they support each other. That's why I'll put this later on because you came in late. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you please elaborate on the similarities and differences of craving, desire, ambition, aspiration, wants, needs, and other related words? From the Buddhist perspective, no, I can't. Next question. Oh, come on. If you want to know the similarities and difference between craving, desire, ambition, aspiration, wants, needs, look in a dictionary. What message... I've got to carry on here because we're getting late. What message did you give corporate leaders at Sanjana Resort on 30th of April 2012. I gave this resort to these corporate leaders. But I cannot tell you because it's corporate confidence. They'll lose their competitive advantage and they'll ask for their money back. No, I just told them about how to lessen stress by putting down the cup. The importance of compassion in Buddha, in business, just like what I teach you. But you know, with corporate people, sometimes the only way you can get corporate people, Francis went as well, the only way you can get corporate people to come on a retreat is making them pay. If they didn't have to pay, they'd think it's worthless. So that's why that was a trick to get them to come. For you guys, I teach you exactly the same. You get it for free. Because, you understand Buddhism. For corporate people, the more you charge, the more they think it's valuable, the more people come. So if you talk, if you want to teach the high flyers, you've got to charge them a lot. Otherwise, they think it's not worth coming. But you guys get exactly the same for much better price. What is wrong in believing in God or cosmic intelligence? The thing about believing in God is when you believe that God will help you. When you go praying to God, God, please help me, God, please help me. There's the standard story of many years ago, just south here in Malaysia, there was very terrible floods. And during those floods, there was one Chinese temple got flooded. And the priest was on top of the roof when the rescue boat came round. You know this story. And the rescue boat shouted out at the priest, "Priest, jump in. The flood waters are rising. We've come to save you." And the priest said, "I am a devotee of Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy. I've been faithful to Kuan Yin all my life. Kuan Yin will save me." So don't be stupid, Reverend. Jump in the boat. The flood waters are rising. No, this is a test of my faith. I believe in Kuan Yin. She'll save me. And they couldn't argue with the priest. So they had to go off and rescue someone else. So the flood waters rose. And so this priest, he was hanging on to those curly things on the end of Chinese temples, on the top of the roof. When the boat came back again, and the boat said, "Look, you are a very courageous priest. You've got such a wonderful reputation. Your faith is so wonderful. Now the waters are still rising. Jump in the boat, we can save you." He said, "Nope. This is a test of my faith. I believe in Kuan Yin. I've worshipped her all my life. Go away. Kuan Yin will save me." No matter how much they argued, he would not jump in the boat. So they had to go away. And the flood waters rose. And now he was hanging on to the TV aerial. The last thing he could hold on to. When the helicopter came, and they dropped the rope ladder, and they said, "Venerable sir, you are amazing. You're awesome. Your faith is legendary. Now, hold on to the rope. We come to save you. This is your last chance." And he shouted out, "No, Kuan Yin will save me. I've got faith in the goddess of mercy. Go away." And they couldn't force him to hang on to the rope. So they had to fly away. And what happened? The flood waters rose and he drowned. He died. And when he went up to heaven, he went searching for Kuan Yin. And when he found her, my goodness, did he scold her. "I had faith in you. I believed in you. I worshipped you. I told other people how you helped them. And you let me die. You terrible Kuan Yin. You're a fake. You're a fraud. You're not real. Why didn't you help me?" And Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy, smiled sweetly and said, "But I did help you. I sent you two boats and one helicopter." That's the trouble. When we believe in God, we don't catch the boat or the helicopter. That's the problem. God will save me. Jesus will save me. Kuan Yin will save me. For goodness sake. These people send you the doctors. Go to the hospital. Does chanting have the same effect as meditation? Of course not. Meditation is much more powerful than chanting. So if you really want to get powerful minds, do more meditation and less chanting. You know what chanting does? If you do a couple of hours, chanting, it's the fact you get sore throat. Meditation never gets sore throat. You may get sore bottom, but not sore throat. How many hours of meditation is recommended per day? Too much can be harmful, is it not? Of course not. The more, the better. I'll tell you an amazing story, which I like telling people. Just how even today there are great monks around. There was a 9-day meditation retreat held in Australia. It was a monk from an Asian country who was teaching this retreat. And he started by everybody meditating for an hour before he'd give the first talk on a Friday evening. After the hour of meditation, he was still meditating. He never came out. So when it came to 10 o'clock, everyone went to bed. There was no talk that night. The monk was still meditating. So they went to bed. When they got up in the morning for the first meditation, the monk was still sitting there. He hadn't moved. He never gave one talk or gave any precepts for 8 days. He just sat in meditation without moving, without eating, without going to the toilet. And after those 8 or 9 days, he came out of meditation and apologized. I'm terribly sorry, I just went into a very deep meditation. I never gave you any talks or gave you the precepts. I said, no, that was so amazing and inspiring to see that monks can actually do that these days. That was the best talk we'd ever heard, to see that a monk can sit perfectly still without moving for 8 days. Wow. So that's how much you can meditate, 24 hours a day. Is that harmful? Not at all. But maybe you might not be able to do that, but it just shows you there's no limit. I practice a Chinese form of meditation called Sheng Qi, or Qi, which translates as original breath. After about 10 sessions, varies between person to person, the energy built up in the lower abdomen shoots over the rectum, up the spine, across the cranium, and back down the front for about half an hour of orgasmic bliss. Is that some form of jhana? It's not, because the energy is going into your body. It should be staying in your mind. That's the problem with that type of meditation. You should be letting go of your body as soon as possible so the energy stays in the mind where it belongs. Then you get the bliss of jhanas. The body has to disappear, first of all. I've seen ladies suffering from depression crumple up and cry from deep joy. It only happens once a lifetime, like the clearance of the meridians. The jhanas happen many times. So you don't only get joy once, again and again and again. Wow, that's cool. How to connect to myself and how to connect to others. Loving kindness. Open the door of your heart to yourself. No matter what you've ever done, no matter who you are, to love yourself as you are. That's how to connect. While meditating, I'm aware of my breath and see the back of my eyelid, dark. Occasionally I see some light activities, though not bright. I'm in moving colours. Should I still be aware of breath or just observe the glows or whatever? Don't do anything. Let your mind decide. When you're meditating, don't try and control. Ask your mind, mind, what do you want to do? What the mind wants to do, that's what you do. Don't make choices. Is it proper practice to buy meals from monks and nuns at a restaurant located in a shopping complex? Does it consider a temptation to them? Depends what the meal is. Because sometimes people buy me meals and it's not what I like. It's not a temptation at all. It's a great disappointment. No, it's okay to do that. Because this is something about food which I found out. For many years when I was in Thailand, I ate disgusting food. I mean, really food that not even anyone would like. No, frog soup, for example. Frog soup was just like little frogs, but they just jumped up into boiling water. There was no salt, there was no garlic, there was no sauces. It was just boiled frog. Not even salt or pepper or chili, nothing. Just water and frog. And that's all you had. And I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. Snails, ants, eggs, a buffalo after birth, all that stuff you ate. Disgusting stuff. It sounds disgusting, doesn't it? And it tasted just the same. Now, I was very tough. I had a very good attitude, so I could eat that stuff. But now my tummy, I start trying to eat that stuff and I get sick. No, basically my tummy's had enough. So that's why usually I eat very mild food now. So now sometimes you have to do that. Otherwise, you can't digest it anymore. And that means you get tummy ache, you feel weak. So that's why even monks, please find out what they can digest. The type of food they like. Now, a lot of times it's not craving, it's just what they can eat. Because my poor body, it hasn't sort of chosen for years. It's eaten what you want to put inside of it. So that's why sometimes it gets a bit sort of weak. Ajahn Brahm, am I breaking precepts if I... This is another one. Hey, how come this comes up together? It's amazing just how these things come up together. Am I breaking any precepts if I buy dinner for the monk upon his request and it has become a daily affair? According to him, he has gastritis. If, as long as it is simple food, and he just asks you, he doesn't say, this is my menu for today. He just says, simple food, maybe sort of no spices and things like that, fine. What is the meaning of your name, Ajahn Brahmawangso? Ajahn means teacher, and Brahmawangso means in the lineage of God, of Brahma. So I have relations in high places. That was just a name given to you. Ajahn Zavaras, if you teenagers have tried many different techniques to find a suitable method to devote to practicing, but can't seem to have appropriate determination effort continuously, how should David proceed, meditation or daily chanting? Look, you need the right type of methods to teach teenagers. That's why we have youth groups. Have teaching for everybody, teaching for the children, teaching for youths. And the best way of getting your sons to come to the youth group is getting beautiful girls to come to that youth group. Because they won't come there for the meditation or for the Dhamma. They'll come there because they've got hot chicks in the youth group. So that's how to get them in there. So tell your son, hey, look at the girls who go to the youth group and they want to go. They're boys. And the same with the girls. Get some really cute guys to go to the youth group and all the girls will want to go there as well. And once you get them in, once you pull them in, then you can teach them meditation. But you've got to have marketing first of all. Ajahn, in a workshop environment, how do you practice mindfulness and compassion when a person keeps getting on your nerves on a daily basis? Never allow anybody to control your happiness. They only get on your nerves because you let them. So be strong. Two ears, whatever they say, in one ear, out the other. That's why you've got two. One to go in, one to go out. And if they say something stupid, don't keep it. Then they don't get on the nerves. When you don't react, then that really gets on their nerves. They can't upset you anymore. Because they can't upset you, they leave you alone. They go and pick on somebody else. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for being here with us. I've got to be somewhere. Just happen to be with you. I seek your guidance. So what can I do to help my dog so that she will have a better rebirth in her next life? One of my disciples over in Melbourne, she got this beautiful Labrador dog and she enrolled it in this pet therapy program. The pet therapy where they train these dogs, they have to be very mild and loving dogs, to go into hospitals. So they go to, say, the cancer ward, where these people, in the ward for weeks at a time, they feel so down and depressed. And they take the nice dog or cat into this ward, and they can stroke the dog, and the dog licks them. They love that. The dog loves it. And actually, they have very good therapeutic results. Sometimes people get cured. People are depressed. They've got a dog to pat, and the dog licks them. They lose their depression. So it's called pet therapy. And so, see, do you have that in Malaysia? Well, maybe somebody started. It's a wonderful Buddhist thing to do. And all the evidence in the medical world is there. It works. Now, you have to train the dogs, get them into the hospital so people can play with them, kids can play with them. They're in the wards, they're in there for many days. The patients love it and they get much better, much quicker. And it also allows your dog to do good karma. Because the dog helps people get better. So it's a wonderful thing for Buddhist dogs and cats to do. Pet therapy. Other than that, you can bring it to the monastery. Because you know, in temples, monks, we don't have girlfriends. We don't have anybody to pat and stroke. So take your dog so the monk can stroke the nice doggy. It makes the monk happier. So you see, making the monk happier is good karma for the dog. But if the dog barks at the monk and bites him, all his good karma has been lost in one bite. Next question. I'm thinking of becoming a monk with the intention to stop myself from suffering of reincarnation, attaining enlightenment. Is that a good reason to become a monk? Yes. If not, what reason to become a monk? I know that many people become a monk because of broken heart. They got dumped by their girlfriend and they become a monk to forget. They leave the world because they've got broken heart. Isn't that romantic? When you see all the monks in the temple, maybe some of them, one day they fell in love and they were rejected. And because they were rejected, they never want to go out with a girl again. So they become a monk instead. Oh. No, that's not a good reason to become a monk. But it's romantic. Sometimes people ask me that. And just for a joke, I say, I became a monk because my girlfriend dumped me when I was young. I became a monk to forget. And I have forgot. No, I haven't forgot. I didn't get dumped that way. I learned meditation so I can become peace and still. Yet being in sales and marketing department, I have to racelessly chase sales and meeting target every day. I'm so drained. Furthermore, my office is having serious office politic war and backstabbing now. Do I just leave and find a new company, feel to start it all over again? I suppose I'm having early midlife crisis. Please advise. Yeah, if you're in sales and marketing, is one of my disciples in Penang, working for a big firm, she applied for this promotion. So many other people applied for this promotion, but she got it. She came to thank me because what worked for her was those Emperor's Three Questions I said yesterday. Now's the most important time. The person in front of you is the most important person in the world. The most important thing to do is to care. That became her philosophy in sales. So the person in front of her was the most important person. And that person realized that this salesperson cares about me. I'm important to her. She got so many sales that way, which is why she got promotion. And even when she saw her boss, and the boss was there, the boss was the most important person in the world. And she cared. The boss felt that and liked her. That's why she got promotion. These Buddhist principles, they're not just for monks and nuns. They're for you. If you just practice those Emperor's Three Questions, you will find that your career takes off, especially in things like sales and marketing. Because what customers want, they want someone they can trust, who's authentic, who cares about them. Have you ever been to a shop and people just don't care about you, you're not important to them? Get out of here, I'm too busy. Do you want to do business with people like that? If someone comes up to you, yes sir, how can I help you? And they're being sincere. You really are important to them. Then you do your business. You get your sales. So if you're in marketing and you have to chase sales, remember those Emperor's Three Questions. Especially number two, the one in front of you is the most important person in the world. You'll find you'll have plenty of time and your sales will go up. And as far as political war and backstabbing, Just there might be a war, but you don't have to fight on either side. Just forget about it. And as far as backstabbing is concerned, as long as you're doing the good work and you're getting the sales, they may try and backstab you, but the boss knows that you're doing the job, which means that you don't get hurt. And anyway, if there is lots of backstabbing, just, you know, always, why can you stop getting backstabbing? I've seen these masks which people wear. I think, where is it in the, I think the Sandakan, is it Sandakan? Not Sandakan. I think something like Sundra Islands, which is just, sorry? Sandaban, this is, oh, they're in Bangladesh. Yes, Sandaban, where they have lots of tigers. And all the people there, they wear these masks which look like a human head on the back. Because the tigers will never attack you face on. They'll only attack you from the back. And so the tigers, when they see this mask, they don't know what's the front, what's the back of a human being. So that's what you can do in the office. Wear a mask which looks like your head, so they don't know what's the back and the front, so they can't backstab you. Either that, or wear a periscope so you can see what they're doing behind your back. Well, I know they've got these things in cars, you know, these reverse parking things, so you can actually see what's going on behind you when you're driving out. Get one of those so you can see what's going on behind you. Okay, so that's 9 o'clock. So it's the end of the day. Some of you have been here since 5:30. Amazing what you've done. So those of you who are gluttons for punishment, you can do the same tomorrow. The more meditation, another talk in the evening. Actually, it's supposed to end at 8:30, so I get an extra half an hour. But I finished all the questions. So thank you for coming. Those of you who are meditating tomorrow, please try and come at 6 o'clock. But look, if you come late, I'm not a strict person, so if you come a bit late, you can just still come into the hall, sit down quietly, don't make a big fuss and bother, and then you can come in. If you really come late, you can just come for breakfast. And after breakfast, you can go home again if you like. So another day of meditating, and again another talk in the evening between 7 to 8:30. So please, before you go, would you like to?
Thank you, Ajahn. In appreciation to Ajahn Brahmavansu, let us together thank Ajahn in the usual manner. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And Ajahn?
Yes. We'll quickly share merits. Please say the Idam Me with me.
Idam Me Niyatina Hotu Sukhita Hontu Yatayo. Idam Me Niyatina Hotu Sukhita Hontu Yatayo. Idam Me Niyatina Hotu Sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
There you go.